Okay, continuing our little audio promenade here, we're at a wonderful stand speaking with the legend that is Chuck Ian Gordon. Chuck, the author, no doubt, of Game Worlds.
Yeah, this is a science fiction novel, and it's a prequel to Three Futures, which will be produced as science fiction novel as well as holodeck musical. And this is what I'm showing here with the first prototype.
So, I mean, this is very much part of the immersive technology that certainly at the University of Lincoln I've actually seen as the whole range of immersive nature where you actually sort of become part of the character, etc. Is this very much the future of literature, really?
I don't know if literature, but probably of entertainment. So when you go to the cinema today, you maybe will go, or to the theater, you maybe will go to the holodeck tomorrow.
Do I detect a slight German accent there?
Yes.
I just thought so.
Yes. And whereabouts?
Sorry?
Where in Germany?
Near Frankfurt.
Ah. Ausgezeichnet, as they say. Fantastic. So what are you making of the, obviously, 72nd World Science Fiction Convention?
It's great to meet people and to get the reactions from people discovering my work. And So I have some feedback how to continue.
Raumschiff Enterprise, of course, the translation of Star Trek over in German. What inspired you to get involved with science fiction, or get involved, obviously, with Game Worlds?
I think it was my dad, because it was 1977 or 78, I don't know, and he brought me to the cinema, so I watched Star Wars, and this changed my life. And I was a great fan of Star Wars and Star Trek. I have old drawings my mother kept, and it was always my world.
So, classic Trek, original series with Kirk, Spock and McCoy, or Next Generation?
Both. But first the classics and then Next Generation, yeah.
Excellent. Fantastic. So share with us, Game Worlds, what's the concept, what's the plot?
The concept is there are artificial intelligences kept in multiplayer Game Worlds, and they don't know it, but they discover it, and they try to escape. There's a hunt through several game worlds, and then they are downloaded to robot bodies, and the hunt continues in the real world.
That seems to be something which, if I was asked to say, what's the theme, if there is such, in terms of WorldCon this time around, I'm sensing artificial realities, I'm sensing avatars, and I'm sensing that sort of notion of what does it mean to be human is coming across.
That's a good question, and the point is, I put in some flying cars. This is just for fun, but everything else, I'm working as an IT professional, is quite realistic. Also, this artificial intelligence stuff. And it's the important question, how do we develop as mankind? What path will we take in the future? And this has a huge impact on our future. Will it be good or will it be bad? And this is the theme of Three Futures, the continuation of that.
And in terms of, obviously, the imagination and the line from that, I'm often struck, if we actually compare the early days of the Nickelodeon cinema and the early days of the 20th century to where cinema has actually developed, what we're looking at here is very much the kind of analogy to that in terms of, obviously, computer technology.
I think that's right. And another thing is happening right now, it's the maker generation or the do-it-yourself generation, because technology is getting cheaper and cheaper. It's not really easy to do this, to do 3D scans, motion capture and all that stuff, but it's getting affordable. So smaller productions can afford to start things like this, and this is quite amazing.
So the Oculus Rift was what I was thinking of, which might sort of have tied into that. We sort of worked through that. But yeah, I think this is very much a case in point within that.
But this is a... Oculus Rift is the star, I think, but this is a very cheap version. You put in your own smartphone. It's from a German company called Duravis. It's called the Duravis Dive. And it's... I think it's €59. So you got a smartphone and €60, and you got your own holodeck, and this is quite amazing. Would you like to have a look into it?
I know you didn't say that. Okay, let's try it. I'll try and give a commentary as we're working around from this point of view, so we'll hopefully see how this goes. This could obviously take me into a whole new dimension. I noticed on the lines here it says...
I think you should take your glasses off, please.
Okay.
Because
yeah,
I don't know.
So, that's all right.
When you have it on,
just
use the handles to put it forward, backwards, and sideways.
Okay,
so
you
have.
Do you want to actually take hold of the microphone?
Yeah,
I'll put it on here, and then I'll sort of hopefully
there you are.
Talk to this. go through that. So, and yes, absolutely. Well, I feel as though I've just entered a whole new dream now. I'm seeing that now.
So, if you have got a sharp image.
Yeah, I've got the image is fine. Yes, that's great.
Then you can turn around and somewhere and there's a lady dancing for you.
I see the Jodrell Bank telescope.
It's an observatory in Chile. It's a real location.
We have a ballerina in almost a Supergirl outfit with a sort of sky blue. Turned away there, obviously embarrassing. Yes, actually, they're doing a plié or pas de deux. Yes, fantastic. What can I say? A genuine sort of experience.
You see,
I have to say, better than the Oculus Rift. I tried the Oculus Rift for one of my colleagues and found that a little bit nauseous, even though it took me through the Starship Enterprise. That idea I found really quite user-friendly.
Thank you.
So good stuff from that point of view. Not a real girl, though.
The girl is...
See, this is what like Barclay in Star Trek The Next Generation. I'll just fall in love with a holodeck fantasy. What's going to happen then?
Yeah, the girl is from a guy, Andres Cucaro, who made it. He's from South America. And the motions are captured from the Carnegie Mellon University. So interesting thing is, for me as an artist, you can put all things together. You can fix it until it's really, really perfect. And then you can... reproduce it and reproduce it again. It's quite revolutionary because it's like theater, but you save the location. You don't need a location, and you save the actors as well. This is nothing the actors will like, probably, but like in cinemas. Yeah, but I think it's...
Think of the lawyers, think of the agents, think of the possible sort of complaints that we've actually got to head for there. They'll be very happy. We can join the real Galactic Rebellion. Again, fantastic stuff. Chuck, it's been a delight touching base with yourself. If people are listening to this, and obviously we just tried to describe a certain experience of the holodeck and 3D scan and line from that, how you can join the Galactic Rebellion and access Game Worlds, not Game World Z. How can people actually access you on the internet?
I think the best way is to go to the site 3futures.com, futures with a Z. And 3 as a number, 3futures.com. There you can subscribe, and I will keep you informed about the Galactic Rebellion and everything I'm doing.
I won't even say engage or make it so, because I think it goes without saying.
Thank you. Live long and prosper.
The great thing about conventions across the planet is, of course, you get a chance to touch base with colleagues from the Fourth Estate, Fifth Estate, and so on. And those of you who can think back in this particular program to when we were talking to, obviously, the fine folk at Titan Publications and Forbidden Planet, etc., might recall us thinking, what about the days when you trotted off to see Alan McKenzie and Des Skin in their Marvel studios? Well, that was a wee while ago. But of course, they were founding fathers, certainly in the case of Des Skin, of Starburst magazine. And who have we actually got in front of us now but from that very same fabulous Starburst magazine, but...
Ed Fortune, hello!
Ed, good to connect with you, good self. Ed, you've just done a fabulous interview with...
Robin Hobbs. She was absolutely lovely. It was divine.
And that will obviously be appearing in future editions of the magazine, which in many ways, back in 76, 77, actually launched, well, basically sort of started running that whole exciting Star Wars thing and has never really looked back, really.
I like to joke that Starburst started with promoting this tiny indie movie called Star Wars, but you've got to remember that back then it was actually a tiny indie movie. It wasn't the blockbuster. We've never stopped being part of the community. We've never stopped being... something that promotes the next big thing, whereas there are other publications available. We tend to concentrate on what's coming years in advance sometimes, and we're blessed with some fantastic contributors.
Of course, back in that day, a bit of nostalgia here, we had the Hammer House of Horror, which I think opened up a whole way for Starburst, and of course we had the openings of the whole system. And at the time, of course, I was often envious of colleagues in the States who had Starlog, which was a wonderful sort of publication from that point of view, and then moved into that. As you rightly say, there are others available on Sci-Fi Now. SFX magazine, we bond with very much from that point of view. But Starburst is continuing to go from strength to strength, much probably due to your good self, Ed. And of course, FAB Cafe in Manchester, another sort of key factor of the whole thing, plus Fab Podcast as well.
Yeah, the Fab Podcasts are great. We've got a thing called Fab Radio International, which embraced the alternative, is its subtitle. And it's got LGBT, it's got gardening, it's got burlesque advice. It's a very weird and wacky radio station. I produce a podcast for the magazine itself, so it's available on Fab Radio International, and it's also available on Starburst magazine called The Bookworm, which is where I've just done an interview for Robin Hobb. But very much we're based in Manchester these days, And it's the spirit of Tony Wilson is something that a lot of people evoke. But in all of my career, I can't think of anywhere that's more embraces the anarchic but progressive fun of what that sentence means. It's very, very Manchester, and it's also a lot of fun.
There are those of us who remember John Brosnan's line with respect to "It's only a movie." I know, John, wherever you're based, it's the Australian side of things there. Jordan Rice has obviously taken that on board now in terms of somewhat acerbic criticism sometimes, and sometimes I might say quite rightly so. But it's all done, to use the vernacular, in good taste.
Perfectly good taste. I mean, my columns, I have two columns. I do Brave New Word, which I tell you what next books are coming up. Sometimes I get it right. And I also do the board games. It's one of those things that board games have just become this huge thing that have always been there. And we suddenly realised that we were missing an angle of the whole of the kind of the cult community. And that's the thing that we serve.
Do I detect a slight Sunderland or Newcastle accent there? It's going to be crucial.
I'm a Sundancer. I'm from South Shields.
Yeah, South Shields. There we are. You see, breaking into that. Well, some of you actually comes from Middlesbrough. Clearly, we're obviously sort of civilising the folk down here.
Yes. I mean, I often joke that I'm from the edge of the wall and the barbarians are on the other side. And it's up to you to decide which side of the wall that is,
of course. Yeah, be careful. We've got one of our fine Scottish correspondents in the background, basically. Who knows what could have... Oh, she's gone. That's, life continues in every sense of the word. Listen, this is the second World Science Fiction Convention. It's already pretty close to breaking records in terms of events this side of the Atlantic. Very close to, obviously, reaching the numbers that we're attending in Los Angeles. SF is no longer ghetto, is it? It's mainstream.
It's become... You see, I would argue that it's always been part of the mainstream. It's just that the guardians of, you know, the mainstream have gotten old and have been replaced by people who embraced that sort of cult. You can't have an imagination without wanting to dream of spaceships and dragons. I think it's, you know, it's going to come there somewhere. And it's a long time in coming, and it's great that we finally merged these things together.
And keeping the Manchester theme going, of course, a little hats off to Fab Cafe, which is also indirectly connected with that, because Alan Stevens sadly couldn't be with us today. Alan Stevens and Fiona Moore are audio producers of The Magic Bullet, a range of audios, etc. He produced a stage play with, I think, Paul Darrow, who was there a year or so ago. So great news there as well.
Oh, that was actually a fantastic day.
Glad you said that. I'm about to do some editing otherwise.
It was a fantastic day. For those who don't know, Fab Radio International and Fab Cafe. Fab Cafe is part of Starburst, and it's a series of bars, mostly around the Northwest. And it's like a little clubhouse, especially for Starburst journalists. You can find all sorts of interesting people in the Fab Caf.
And you've raised that thing, and I think you more or less now have convinced us that we really should do a location report in the Fab Cafe in Manchester. We should make our way there.
I think that's an excellent excuse for a drink.
Having started the day with Dave Bradley, of course, from SFX magazine, moved on to Farrah Mendelssohn and a whole heap of other goodies, including the British Interplanetary Society and a whole range of other things, you might sort of say, oh, can it get any better? Of course it can. It's only day two, and we've got Louis Savvy here, the genius behind Sci-Fi London, and also a key part of the film programme for the 72nd World Science Fiction event. Louis, good to see you as ever.
Hello, Alex. How are you?
Very good. As I say, it's interesting comparing the XL, because this is about the fifth event I've been at here. A couple of boat shows, one of the SFX events, way back in the early parts of the 21st century. And I think they seem to be getting it right. I mean, it's huge. It is literally, I suppose, given away by the fact it's got two different Dockland railways serving itself. But it's good. But I did acknowledge Stratford as I passed by, obviously.
Jolly good, jolly good. Yes, you know, part of the home of the festival. So, but yeah, XL is a huge venue. Actually, we were having a very silly conversation yesterday about people who are in wheelchairs here, because there's lots of ramps, there's lots of runways, and actually, we thought it'd be really quite cool to have one. So. If you see any people who've been thrown out of their wheelchairs, it's probably Sci-Fi London, and I apologise now.
Yeah, okay, obviously keeping it partially controversial as ever. Speaking of which, of course, I mean, we could actually, if we're using football scores, say, well, it's World Science Fiction Conventions in London 3, Sci-Fi London 14. So, you know, great result there.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. No, this is, I'm obviously delighted to be part of it. It, it. We were asked a year or so, maybe even longer than that, actually, to help with the bid for London to get it, and obviously delighted when that happened. And actually, we're not showing an awful lot of stuff here. That, you know, the media programme is obviously just a part of the stream. There's, you know, there are hundreds and hundreds of events going on here. But the audiences have been good. They've enjoyed the stuff we've showed them so far. As you say, it's only day two, so we'll see.
I think the general flavour I'm getting of this, and this is actually my first official science fiction event as a convention. I've attended media conventions before, obviously, as you know, Sci-Fi London, it goes without saying, is a number one attending. But my general flavour is, having read extensively over the years about the Hugo Awards and the hushed tones about that and so on, is that the general vibe is good. I think it's certainly well structured, it's well put together. It's interesting in terms of, obviously, if you took the volunteers out, a bit like the Olympic Games, it would die.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I mean, conventions are very different to media events, you know, as you say, there. And the Worldcon, you know, it's started as a literary convention, and still at its core, it's about the books, it's about literature, and science fiction, not sci-fi, which is, I guess, what we would use in media a little more.
I think a lot of people are kind of blurring the boundaries now, because certainly a lot of the exhibitors I was speaking to today were referring to, obviously, the huge success of George R.R. Martin, and surely, as we know, that is hardcore fantasy.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But I think it's... I mean, it's the thing I've always said about people who love science fiction, is that they also love fantasy, they like westerns, and they read and enjoy or watch crime and thrillers and whatever else. If it's got a good story and engaging characters, they're into it. So so I don't think it's a surprise necessarily that Game of Thrones is here, given that George Martin, you know, is here. A lot of people are big fans of the show, if not the books, so, or both.
The brochure has a welcome from Boris Johnson, which is, I think, probably ratcheting up the level for next year, obviously, in Sci-Fi London, which is quite nice. It's also had, I think, for the first time in its history, a big plug in The Guardian in terms of an event itself. Does that mean science fiction has gone mainstream? It's not going mainstream, it is mainstream.
I don't know if it ever was mainstream, will become mainstream, or is mainstream. I think science fiction is, you know, just there, the same as everything else, really. You know, if you're a fan, you're into it, and you find the things you want to find, and if you're not, you discover it, stumble across it, you come to something like Sci-Fi London. You know, again, we were set up for discovery. You know, we were set up to say, look, yeah, it's great, you can go and see Transformers, you know, on any screen in the country, but you're not going to see Suicide or Lulu in a World Made for Two, you know, which is an independent black and white.
Or Mood Indigo.
Exactly, or Mood Indigo for that point. I mean, actually, you know, Michel Gondry's film has had a very limited theatrical exposure. So
I was quite saddened by our film critic Richard Fitzwilliam's views on Mood Indigo. He didn't really rate it. In fact, he was far more prone to eulogise about Guardians of the Galaxy and Planet of the Apes, or Dawn of Planet of the Apes.
Well, I think Michel Gondry's films can sometimes be...
an acquired taste.
They're kind of Marmite, yeah, or Vegemite for anyone from the Antipodean region who's listening. I had to make a correction yesterday, actually, because somebody... Marmite? You know, sorry, Vegemite. But I think, yeah, I mean, I think you can... You know, he's made some fantastic films. You know, I'm certainly Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Hornet.
Is a classic. So,
less so.
Not quite so classic, but...
Being John Malkovich?
Yeah.
Well, no, Spike Jonze.
I think that's, you know, that as a film, again, is one that I think when people have seen it, they kind of fall in love with it, you know. But he's also made...
Science of Sleep.
He's made a few, you know, not so strong films. And I think Mood Indigo is a little bit, you know, it's an unusual film in that it does have a... Well, without giving too many spoilers, but it's not the happiest of endings.
It fades, it goes from colour to monochrome.
And actually, Michel Gondry was at the last festival, along with the two leads, Romain Duras and Audrey Tautou were there. And he was talking about when he'd read the book, because it's a classic French novel by Boris Vian. And I actually haven't read it, but my missus has. But Michel Gondry said that when he was reading it, it felt to him like a book that became black and white, you know, as he was kind of visualising things.
It's probably French existentialism to me, really.
Yeah, and again, I think that's why it becomes a little bit of a Marmite film. You know, you either like that spread on your toast or you won't go near it. So,
speaking of filmmakers, Louis, of course, it's very important to acknowledge that Phil Leonis and Dean Haglund still doing the weekly Chilpack Hollywood podcasts from the heart of downtown Hollywood. And Phil, of course, regularly being our cultural correspondent at 6:30 every Wednesday on Siren 107.3 FM, which, of course, thanks to your good self, Louis, because that moment when you introduced us, you know, who would have thought, you know, 4 years later, Phil's still entertaining the British audiences live on Siren.
Phil loves a chat. And so if you're listening, Phil, hello. And it'd be great to catch up again soon. You know, I've heard a rumour that they're going to be over towards the end of the year. So it'd be nice to catch up.
Truth is out there, Ancient Mysteries 2, it's getting gradually put together. And, of course, he's doing post-production on The Lady Killers and in doing a whole stack of other things together with Lily Holloman and the whole side of things. So great stuff there.
Yeah, no, absolutely. He's prolific, if nothing else. So
he's prolific and talented, I think, Louis. I'll take that line.
And a very lovely, handsome man. Yeah.
Well, and Ilana Rain is also prolific, talented, and a very lovely, handsome lady.
With less facial hair, so...
Indeed. Yes. So moving on, Sci-Fi London, the plans presumably all beginning to take shape for 2015?
Slowly they are. We often run an October, November.
I was going to say, yes.
But this year we're going to skip a year, I think, because there's an awful lot going on science fiction-wise in the UK. Obviously, Worldcon now. And then the BFI season kicks off in October and runs for 3 months. And there are some 124 venues involved across the country. It's about 570-odd screenings and events going on. So it's going to be a huge, huge landscape of science fiction events, and I'm looking to, you know, we're doing some shorts and some stuff at Bletchley Park and various other things with that. So we thought we'd skip our Oktoberfest, and plans are to look towards again early May for the next festival, but I haven't confirmed the dates yet. You'll be the second person to know once I've decided.
Well, I'm thinking, I will actually bowl this one out here. We're thinking about certainly inviting you as a guest of honour and probably providing a keynote session for what we're looking to put together for next year's Lincoln Inspired Festival, actually up at Lincoln University, a science fiction symposium. So would you be up for that?
Of course, absolutely. Absolutely.
Thinking how to run a film festival for the uninitiated, all about science fiction, could be a working title.
Yeah, no, that's no problem at all. I also give a lecture on no-budget science fiction filmmaking as well, with my very, very opinionated comments.
The 48-hour film challenge would not be the same without you. And just a reminder, who actually won the 48-hour film challenge this year?
It was a guy called Josh Fortune, and it was a film called The March, and you can see it on our website at scifilondon.com to get the plug in. It's lovely, and it was quite controversial because it's an animated film. So all of these teams of filmmakers that got together to go out and shoot all of this stuff over that weekend, and we had 217 films, new science fiction films made in that weekend. It was an animated film actually that won it, and it's a lovely, really, really beautiful film, beautifully told, very simply animated. And yeah, very, very proud of what happened with that one.
I'm just smiling if you are on video looking at the sign mobile parking. I thought, is that for the phone? No, obviously it's something completely different.
That's for anyone who needs access on wheels, basically.
Yes. Yeah, precisely.
But, yeah. Exactly. So, but I was going to say, talking of the 48-hour, we're currently working with Wildseed Studios at the moment. We've just seen 18 of the teams from this year's 48-hour. We're making the decision, I hope, within the next 2 weeks to take 5 of those teams, and then we're going to spend the next 3 months mentoring them, doing some script development, and then at Christmas we'll pick one of them, and we've got the money to make a feature film, which we hope to start shooting in the spring. So so watch out for that. There'll be a brand new feature film off the back of the 48-hour, and I'm really excited about that.
That's right. So Sci-Fi London continues to grow from strength to strength. Louis, it's been fabulous touching base as ever. And we'll speak again, I'm sure, in the very near future.
Indeed. Thank you again, Alex.
Yes. Well, we're still with the fabulous Louis Savvy. And Louis, you've just introduced us to a wonderful person. And this wonderful person is?
We're here at LondonCon 3 with Dick Fiddy, who is... well, an expert extraordinaire on small screen as well as other things. And Dick, introduce yourself.
Yeah, my name's Dick Fiddy. I work at the BFI. Amongst the things I do there, which is a bit of TV consultancy and all things to do with the small screen. But the reason I'm here is because I coordinate our Missing Believe Wiped initiative, which attempts to track down missing programmes from the British archives and restore them. Over the years, we've recovered a number of different sci-fi themed programmes, and I'm here today to talk about those.
Certainly the Doctor Who excitement earlier in the year and Nigeria sprang to mind in terms of aspects of that. And it was, in retrospect, something which the BBC noted for in terms of they junked so much of their stuff because they either just literally, as you said, wiped their videotapes, etc. Very short-sighted.
I'm not so sure it was. I think at the time, I can't conceive that they could have done anything else. Those tapes were extraordinarily expensive. When colour TV came along, there was a feeling throughout the industry that black and white was no longer viable. And also, if they constantly have had a hostile press, the BBC, if a member of the tabloid press group had found out that they were sitting on tens of thousands of tapes worth £300,000-£400,000, which they could have reused, I think they would have been pilloried. So I think it was good financial sense to reuse them. Yes, and looking back on it now, it looks like cultural vandalism. But at the time, I don't think it was a short-sighted move. I just think it was one of those things nobody predicted that technology would change the face of archive TV and its worth. Nobody could have predicted that at the time. And ITV did exactly the same.
In terms of looking for material, clearly you mentioned ITV, the Avengers series obviously springs to mind, and a whole range of other factors from the early days. Are there any holy grails, things that you sort of think, ooh, that would make my day if we could actually find that particular one? And it wasn't lost after all.
Oh, absolutely. I think Madhouse on Castle Street, the Bob Dylan play from made in 62, showed in 63, I think, in which he was discovered in Greenwich Village as a beat poet and brought over this country by Philip Saville, the director. And we know a copy survived after the screening, but after the broadcast, but we don't know what happened to it. And Dylan fans have been looking after that for 50 years, so if that turns up, it would make you think that anything could. But there are lots of holy grails, really, because there's it would be nice to get a complete run of Not Only But Also. It would be nice to get, you know, some more Doctor Who's back. The thing about Doctor Who is that despite the fact that they sometimes get a bad press, the fans or certain elements of the fan get a bad press, they were actually instrumental in alerting us to the fact that you could do this sort of search. They were so rabidly obsessive about trying to find the lost episodes that they demonstrated that if you looked hard enough, you did have a chance of finding them.
So is it partial hats off to Ian Levine as well?
Hats off to everyone that was involved in the early days, yeah. Christine Slattery at the BBC, who sort of first took the initial steps in trying to restore or create the archive. Because at a library, they never had an archive. The approach to television in those days, in the 60s in particular, was it was an ephemeral medium. They didn't look back at all. They only looked forward. They plunged all their efforts into making new programmes. They were on a treadmill. Remember, they having to make so many programmes every week, keep in, week out. You know, there was no time really for assessment. They didn't really even have repeats as we know them. Repeats in those days meant that the show would have been repeated within a 3-year period whilst it was still under contract. They didn't have the idea of nostalgic archive repeats, retrospective television like that. That didn't come in until Channel 4 in the 80s.
I see what you mean, though. A positive, welcome archive of knowledge when it comes to matters televisual.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we all bow to Dick's knowledge and just keep... Everyone kicks him up the backside and said, more, please tell us, don't keep it a secret.
Absolutely, we're going to A for Andromeda before too long, I'm sure. There's another sort of SF series. Dick, you're here for the Missing Believe Wiped setup. People are listening to this particular piece. Can they still get involved with the BFI if they might have a lead? Are you the person to alert?
Yeah, absolutely. Again, my email, dick.fiddy@bfi.org.uk, is always open for people with any leads, and we will try and track down anything they think they might have. Negotiating with collectors and foreign archives can be tricky at times, which is sometimes why there seems to be a long period between being alerted that something survives and finally getting it back to the archives. But it's worth playing the softly, softly approach because, I mean, our main aim is just to get the piece back in one piece.
I remember a time in the 1880s where people were worrying about cinematic stock literally exploding before, obviously, digital restoration actually took place. And some of the Hollywood classic movies, not only were they actually losing their colour, they were literally just turning to ashes.
That's true, but if you see a well-kept nitrate print, it's still one of the most beautiful things you could ever see projected. absolutely utterly enchanting.